In the chlorinated world of competitive swimming, few names shine as brightly as Katie Ledecky. With 29 of the top 30 times in history for the 800-meter freestyle and a collection of Olympic medals that would make Michael Phelps proud, Ledecky has revolutionized women's swimming. Yet behind the superhuman performances lies a surprisingly relatable person who once stopped repeatedly on the lane line during her first race at age 6, just trying to finish. Her journey from that hesitant beginning to Olympic glory wasn't predestined. It was built through thousands of early mornings, millions of strokes, and an unshakable love for the water that began the moment she first took the plunge. Swimming remains hard, she reflects, but that's what makes it great. Beyond her athletic prowess, Ledecky's story has captured imaginations worldwide, with her chocolate milk balancing act going viral and her technique being studied by coaches globally. Even Bruce Springsteen, when shown her Olympic medals backstage, marveled, "I always wondered what athletes do with these things." Her story isn't just about swimming. It's about finding your element and pursuing excellence with unwavering dedication. My swimming journey began at the Palisades Pool in Bethesda, Maryland, a modest outdoor 25-meter community pool that became the foundation of my swimming career. When I joined at age 6, my mother had no grand Olympic aspirations. She simply wanted my brother Michael and me to enjoy swimming and make friends. The DMV, DC, Maryland, Virginia, was a swimming hotbed that produced champions like Michael Phelps and Kate Ziegler, with approximately 80 different pools in the Montgomery County Swim League alone. Palisades wasn't an exclusive country club, but a welcoming community where families bonded over teen barbecues, pasta pep rallies, and fun Fridays. Young swimmers would play games with the teenagers, creating an environment where kids of all ages supported each other. We'd make posters and wear crazy outfits to meets. I once wore a Halloween wig to every event one summer. This unpretentious atmosphere fostered genuine connections while teaching us to compete with joy. My earliest swimming memories remain vivid, learning to breathe properly from teenage coach Catherine Pitcher, getting my first swim cap, adorned with a frog when I had an ear infection, and the exhilaration of swimming across the pool without stopping for the first time. Summer league swimming created a special rhythm for our family. Morning practices followed by donuts, Wednesday evening B meets, Friday pasta rallies, and Saturday morning A meets with extended barbecues afterward. As my skills developed, swimming gradually consumed every spare minute of our lives. It demanded total commitment, early bedtimes, homework completed on weekends, proper nutrition, and countless sacrifices. Our family schedule revolved around my swimming routine, limiting visits to my grandmother's farm, and requiring pools wherever we traveled. In 2014, 2 years after my first Olympics and fresh off breaking two world records, I returned to swim one final summer league meet at Palisades. I participated in all the familiar rituals, the warm-up, the Palisades rip-ram cheer, the team barbecue. Watching the new eight-and-unders, I saw my younger self in their joy. Unlike every other meet of my career, I didn't obsess over my times that day. I simply embraced being back where my swimming journey began. I still belong to Palisades, as does my family. After the 2023 World Championships, my first swim of my Paris Olympic year happened right there, a meaningful full-circle moment. The pool displays a cardboard cutout of me holding the inflatable porpoise mascot and a plaque commemorating my Olympic journey. What makes me proudest is seeing young swimmers looking at the record board, talking about breaking my times, just as I once did with previous champions' records. My brother Michael was thrilled when our mother announced she was having another baby, even expressing a preference for a sister. After my birth, we became inseparable companions. As the typical younger sibling, I adopted his interests as my own. We shared preferences, loving dogs, distrusting cats, activities, summer reading lists, piano lessons, choir, and movie favorites, School of Rock, Miracle, Monsters, Inc., though we disagreed about Annie, which I loved to his annoyance. Michael was academically driven, deciding in fourth grade to earn straight A's, a goal he nearly achieved through high school. What he taught me was invaluable. He didn't care about popularity or conforming. This gave me permission to be different too, not worrying about wet hair or unfashionable clothes as I balanced swimming and school. His blend of goofiness and intensity attracted friends, and we competed in everything from board games to pancake eating contests. Yet, unlike many siblings, we rarely fought. When we joined the Palisades Porpoises at ages 9 and 6, Michael could already swim a full pool length. He improved dramatically that first summer, dropping 20 seconds in the 50 free and earning most improved honors. At season's end, he was selected for a countywide all-star relay meet. On our family video, Michael proudly declares in his all-star shirt, "It's almost like the Olympics," never imagining his little sister hopping around in the background would be at the real Olympics just 9 years later. As we both progressed in swimming, Michael joined a year-round program at American University, and I followed. We developed a habit of coaching each other on technique. Though Michael finished near the top of local age group rankings in butterfly, he eventually hit a ceiling with swimming while pursuing perfect grades and journalism projects. He struggled when I began beating his times, once breaking his goggles in frustration after losing to me in a 200-meter freestyle. While swimming became my path, journalism became his. He covered the 2012 Olympic trials as a credentialed reporter, watching with pride as I recovered from a disappointing third-place finish in the 400 free to win the 800 free and qualify for the Olympics. When Michael left for Harvard during my sophomore year of high school, just after I'd won gold in London, I felt empty without my confidant and touchstone. Even after I'd become an Olympic champion, Michael still looked out for me, like teaching me to ride a bike properly before I headed to Stanford at 19. After hours of practice in the park, focusing especially on dismounting, my weakness was stopping, I finally gained the confidence of a typical 9-year-old cyclist. As always, Michael helped me find my balance, then sent me on my way. When I was 11, I joined Coach Yuri Sugiyama's elite group at Curlberg Swim Club after breaking my first two Potomac Valley swimming records as a 10-year-old. Yuri, a former All-American swimmer at North Carolina, managed our diverse squad brilliantly, finding unique ways to motivate each swimmer while encouraging team bonding through activities like scavenger hunts through downtown DC. Recognizing my potential early, Yuri had me come in for extra workouts with teammates my age when I was 12, focusing on dry land training, jump rope, and shoulder exercises to prevent future injuries. This foresight was crucial. Many swimming prodigies push too hard too soon, developing overuse injuries that derail their careers. Yuri invested in my long-term health before we even knew what long-term would mean. At 13, Yuri added weekly sessions focused on correcting my freestyle stroke. I had a habit of swinging my arm outward, creating torque that could eventually damage my shoulder. After a year of constant reminders to bend my elbow, Yuri finally said sternly, "Katie, don't come crying to me in 10 years if your shoulder is wrecked." That uncharacteristic sternness made such an impact that I never swung my arm again. The breakthrough came during a practice in 2011 when I was 14. Finishing a tough set with an extra hard kick, my body naturally galloped in the water. Yuri immediately recognized something special, exclaiming, "That's it. That's the stroke you need to swim with all the time." It was a eureka moment that refined my entire approach to swimming. Though the swim community erroneously viewed it as a men's technique, this loping stroke opened a new realm of potential achievement for me. After that breakthrough, Yuri sent me videos of Michael Phelps swimming with a similar galloping form. Unlike Phelps, whose physique was genetically ideal for swimming, my body had no natural proportional advantages. To compensate, we refined my stroke to create a quick connection to the water using a high elbow catch, with a gallop that allowed me to glide slightly longer on one side, propelling me forward like a keeling sailboat. As my technique improved, I began racing against and beating much older swimmers. At a 2010 sectional meet in Buffalo, I won 5 events against high schoolers 4 years older. At my first junior national meet, I won the distance event against college-recruited seniors, with teammates chanting, "She's in 8th grade." Despite my progress in the pool, I struggled with communication. Yuri gave me a journal to track my practices, nutrition, sleep, and feelings, helping me express what I couldn't verbalize, including my Olympic aspirations. The journal became our way of communicating about the Olympics without the pressure of discussing it aloud. At 13, Yuri methodically prepared me for Olympic trials, having me practice the same sets on consecutive days to simulate the competition format. He insisted I experience junior nationals before senior nationals, wanting me to feel I belonged at elite competitions. His belief in me was transformative. He told me I could be one of the best swimmers ever, not just among female distance swimmers. He created an environment where I could train like a champion while remaining a kid. With my 800 freestyle scheduled for day 6 of the 2012 London Olympics, I could fully experience the opening ceremony in my Ralph Lauren Team USA uniform, marveling at the sheer number of athletes who'd overcome countless obstacles to be there. Danny Boyle's Isles of Wonder ceremony was spectacular, featuring Paul McCartney and Queen Elizabeth with James Bond, a moment I excitedly emailed my coach about. The Olympic Village felt like a video game, dodging speedwalkers, mingling with weightlifters, basketball players, and gymnasts from every country. I spent my first 5 days as a fan, attending every swimming session, learning the flow of the meet, and cheering teammates from the deck. Unfortunately, Yuri couldn't get pool deck credentials and was stuck in the stands. After finishing third in preliminaries behind hometown favorite Rebecca Adlington and Denmark's Lotte Friis, I met Yuri outside for crucial last-minute advice. Breathe more to my right side, be more controlled, and channel the crowd's energy for Rebecca down my own lane. The media completely overlooked me, focusing on the nail-biting final between Rebecca and Lotte, which actually worked to my advantage. Before my race, I received a high five and good luck, have fun out there from Michael Phelps in the ready room, a full circle moment from when I'd been just another young fan seeking his autograph. As I walked onto the deck amid deafening chants of Becky, Becky, I mentally transformed them into Ledecky, Ledecky, and channeled that energy. I took the lead by the 50-meter mark, settled into my pace, and by 150 meters had broken away. At 200 meters, I was ahead of world record pace, while commentators dismissed my early surge as inexperience, certain I would soon tire. By 600 meters, I had an epiphany. This was just another 200 freestyle, something I'd done thousands of times. I felt vibrant and present, registering every detail, the Olympic signage, the crowd waving Becky banners, the churning water. For the final 200 meters, I swam alone, touching the wall to become the youngest Olympic women's 800 free champion ever, breaking Janet Evans' 23-year-old US record and beating Rebecca by over 5 seconds. Rebecca was incredibly gracious, swimming over to hug me immediately and telling me how amazing I was. My family was in shock, except my 86-year-old great-uncle Red, who had confidently wagered with locals that I would win. After the medal ceremony, our neighbors threw me an American flag, and I was whisked away for press interviews where I expressed my disbelief at what had just happened. Back home in Bethesda, I received invitations to events, including throwing the first pitch at a Nationals game, and a local deli renamed their omelet Katie's Gold Medal Omelet. I visited the White House with Team USA, where President Obama mentioned me by name, noting I still had to finish my summer reading assignments. Vice President Biden jokingly asked if I'd completed them. Returning to Stone Ridge as a sophomore was an adjustment. Though my classmates and teachers helped normalize things, I gradually realized my life had changed. I was now a public figure with an international audience. With my brother away at college, I worked to balance my new identity as an Olympic gold medalist with being a regular teenager, reminding myself daily that I was more than just a swimmer. Distance swimming is often described as an excruciating, mind-numbing tedium, hours staring at the dark line on the pool bottom while your body screams in agony. But for me, swimming has always been a pleasure, even when testing my limits. Water is 800 times denser than air. During long distances, muscles flood with lactic acid, causing fatigue and cramps. Your body questions your brain. Seriously, how long are you going to make me keep doing this? The challenge is how you respond to pain. Do you quit or push through? I've reached a point where I can acknowledge pain during races and change nothing, holding my stroke, rhythm, and pace, sometimes even going faster. I've found that sweet spot between torment and success. Without mental focus, your brain defaults to self-preservation, signaling you to stop. I recognized early that I had unusual focus and competitive nature. After my first summer at Palisades Pool, I continued other sports but always chose swim practice over any activity. Around age 7, I began setting specific want times, goals I'd write down and track privately. The more far-fetched an objective seems, the more it motivates me. I discovered my aptitude for distance events around age 11 after swimming my first mile and thinking, that wasn't so bad. While teammates dreaded long distances, I embraced them. Distance events offer wiggle room for strategy and more time to think and react. Mentally, I'm wired as an aerobic swimmer who embraces routine. The endless laps become a meditation. After 15 years as a distance swimmer, I don't fight the water's resistance, but allow it to lift me up. Freestyle is my preferred stroke, unfussy with observable rules. Though I've tried all strokes, I've never enjoyed backstroke with its water up the nose and limited visibility. When swimming, I become a human metronome, hearing my heartbeat and the rhythmic whoosh of water as I breathe every 2 strokes. During races, I count laps and maintain positive self-talk, breaking down remaining distances into manageable segments. Song lyrics with good rhythm help distract from pain. U2's Beautiful Day or Bruce Springsteen tunes match my stroke tempo perfectly. My technique has changed how women race distance events, particularly the 400 freestyle, which is now approached almost as a sprint. After becoming the world's top female swimmer in multiple freestyle distances, my technique became obsessively studied. The Mayo Clinic noted I was dominating by the widest margin in international sport, while coaches attributed my success to my body working in perfect unison. Though uncomfortable with such analysis, I've always focused on measuring myself rather than becoming a yardstick for others. My brother calls me extraordinarily ordinary. My coaches consistently attribute my success to hard work, never hitting snooze, eagerly taking feedback, implementing changes quickly, and thriving on improvement rather than wins. My favorite aspect of technique and training is finishing strong, even in practice. Those final 15 meters reveal character, who you are when no one's watching. I always power to the wall, leaving nothing untapped, because doing otherwise would mean letting myself down. I always have to try. My success wasn't built in isolation. It was shaped by remarkable family members who instilled values that guide me both in and out of the pool. My father's life revolves around family, sports, and Bruce Springsteen. Growing up in New York during the golden era of sports, he developed a passion that influenced me profoundly. Through him and my Uncle John, who became a Washington Capitals hockey team owner, I was exposed to professional athletes from a young age, which demystified them for me. Dad filled our home with laughter and music, especially Bruce Springsteen, whom he's seen perform over 50 times. During our early morning drives to swim practice in our Toyota Sienna, now on its 4th Olympic cycle, Dad would educate me about Springsteen. I didn't get my driver's license until 20, partly because I cherish these car rides together, hearing his stories while listening to Bruce. In 2016, after the Olympics, we met Springsteen backstage at Nationals Park. When I showed him my Olympic medals, Bruce, winner of Tonys, Oscars, and Grammys, held one and remarked, "I always wondered what athletes do with these things." My mother, Mary Jen, was actually the first Letiki to excel in swimming. Family lore describes her as a swimmer who always went full throttle, maintaining a relentless pace regardless of discomfort. As one of the early beneficiaries of Title IX, she received a swimming scholarship and competed at nationals 3 times. Beyond swimming achievements, she was praised for her character, an unselfish, humble girl with a strong faith. These values shaped our family priorities. Try your best, but be a good person first. When my swimming career took off, Mom resisted pressure to uproot our lives or homeschool me. She and Dad were determined I remain a typical kid outside the pool. We talk almost daily, sharing an absurd sense of humor. She's been there for every practice, meet, and disappointment. My grandparents also played pivotal roles in my development. My grandpa Jaromír, Jerry, Ledecký, fled Czechoslovakia in 1947 during the Soviet takeover, leaving his family behind to pursue freedom in America. Working as a dishwasher while studying, he eventually earned a doctorate in economics from NYU and became a professor, a remarkable achievement for someone who lost his mother at 6 and often went hungry under an uncaring stepmother. His tenacity and pursuit of the American dream influence me when I represent the United States. My grandpa Edward Bud Hagen served as a combat surgeon with the 1st Marine Division in the Pacific during World War II, working tirelessly in foxholes during brutal battles like Peleliu and Okinawa. Despite suffering 8 shattered ribs from a mortar blast, he refused evacuation, insisting on being taped up so he could continue treating wounded Marines. His heroism earned him a Silver Star, 2 Bronze Stars, and a Purple Heart. Returning to Willingston, North Dakota, he established a medical clinic and dedicated himself to community service, even spearheading construction of Willingston's first indoor pool in 1969 after witnessing drowning incidents. These family foundations, resilience, service, hard work, and integrity remain central to who I am as both a person and an athlete. In summer 2020, I created a promotional TikTok for chocolate milk that went viral, swimming a full pool length with a glass of chocolate milk balanced on my head. Using fins and a snorkel, I completed the feat on my first try, maintaining perfect head position with locked abs and smooth arm strokes. The video exploded worldwide, inspiring other champions like Mark Spitz and Susie O'Neill to attempt their own versions. This stunt represents what being a successful woman athlete feels like, making something incredibly difficult look easy, while knowing one tiny mistake could bring everything tumbling down. I've been fortunate to have amazing female role models throughout my career, starting with my mom, who set high standards for hard work while teaching grace and sportsmanship. My early coaches at Palisades were Catherine and Natalie Pitcher, teenagers who mentored me, followed by Carolyn Coucher, who taught me essential skills like energy management and meat preparation. Training alongside fast female teammates showed me that women could be unapologetically great. However, as I advanced, women coaches became scarce. A 2021 study graded swimming an F in gender equity, with only 20.5% of women's programs led by female coaches. This persists despite research showing women outscoring men in leadership capabilities, highlighting how women must work twice as hard for recognition. Female athletes face contradictory expectations about our bodies and behavior. We must win with humility, while male athletes are celebrated for braggadocio. We're criticized for being too masculine or too aggressive, or conversely, too sexy or not sexy enough. Unlike male athletes who are validated purely for performance, women face pressure to smile more or enhance their appearance. Media coverage of female athletes remains problematic. After winning the 800 freestyle and setting a world record in 2016, an AP article headlined, "Michael Phelps ties for silver in 100 fly," with my accomplishment relegated to a tiny subheading. Male swimmers are often asked to comment on my abilities, with quotes like Ryan Lochte saying, "She swims like a guy," or Connor Yeager noting, "Her stroke is like a man's stroke." While meant as compliments, these comments reveal how swimming like a man remains the yardstick for excellence, and getting beaten by a girl is considered inherently demoralizing. Thankfully, commentator Rowdy Gaines got it right when he said, "She doesn't swim like a man, she swims like Katie Ledecky." My focus is on beating the clock and raising women's swimming to a new level. I'm proud to have been the first winner of the women's 1500 free at the Olympics, thinking of all the talented women who never had that opportunity. We still need parity in investment, salaries, and media coverage for women's sports, which statistically attract more viewers when properly promoted. The good news is that women athletes form a supportive sorority. At the 2012 Olympics, Rebecca Adlington guided me through medal ceremonies despite her own disappointment, while Rebecca Soni and Dana Vollmer looked out for me as a 15-year-old Olympic rookie. I've tried paying this forward, like when I showed Danish competitor Lotte Fries around DC when she moved to train in the US. Despite media attempts to manufacture rivalries between women athletes, my experience is that we motivate and support each other. My commitment to swimming makes friendship challenging. I'm unavailable for late nights, eat early, and spend free time napping. I've avoided peer pressure to drink or smoke, knowing it would undermine my swimming. My social life has been limited. I attended just one school dance in high school, the winter ball after the London Games, where I was crowned Snow Princess. My brother Michael arranged for me to go with Brennan, a Gonzaga swim team member. My mom drove us both ways, and though I enjoyed being with classmates, I never attended homecoming or prom. Swimming demands total commitment, which is why I've never had alcohol or cigarettes, prioritizing my performance above typical teenage experiences. This dedication has limited my romantic life, though I have deep friendships. I sometimes wonder if I'm shutting myself off from people, but I'm mindful of what drains versus recharges me. I want a family someday, but see myself swimming professionally until at least 2028, when I'll be 31. The timing of motherhood is complicated for women athletes racing multiple clocks. At Stanford, I was nicknamed Dex to distinguish me from another Katie on the team. Beyond its academic reputation, Stanford was swimming nirvana, with two 50-meter pools, a 25-yard competition pool, and a diving well. I eventually chose psychology as my major, with a minor in political science. Though I anticipated bonding with my swim teammates, the friendships I formed beyond swimming surprised me. Being surrounded by ambitious classmates, from cancer researchers to polyglots, created an environment like the Olympic Village, making me want to be my best self. My college experience was disrupted when I went on hiatus to prepare for Tokyo, then the pandemic hit. I finished my degree virtually, missing graduation ceremonies and traditional celebrations. When COVID-19 shut down Stanford's facilities, my teammate Simone Manuel and I trained in a generous alumni's backyard pool for 3 months. The pandemic taught me to adapt and appreciate what truly matters. Swimming became more than just a path to achievement. It provided purpose, sanity, and joy during isolation. Beyond swimming, I've discovered the power of the gold medal while visiting wounded veterans at Walter Reed and children at Children's National Hospital. These experiences have recalibrated what I consider heroic and shown me how I can use my platform to bring the world together and do good. Reflecting on my journey, I recall speaking to the graduating class at Little Flower, where I advise students not to be intimidated by youth, to be gracious in victory and defeat, to help others, and to find role models beyond sports. As I continue swimming faster than I was 2 years ago, I'm aware my career won't last forever. While I'd like to be remembered as a noteworthy swimmer, it's equally important to me to be seen as kind and caring. I haven't decided when I'll retire, perhaps after the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics, or maybe later. Unlike some swimmers who plan to never look at water again after retiring, I know I'll swim my entire life. That's why I now swim every Sunday on my own terms. No coach, no pressure, just me and the water. It's my sanctuary, a preview of my future self smiling with a smile on my face.